This is Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford. The 6th annual Piedmont Land Jam features Steep Canyon Rangers and MIPSO with special guest Laurelyn Dossett. It's the Piedmont Land Conservancy's most successful education outreach event. For the past 25 years, PLC has been permanently protecting important lands to conserve our region's natural and scenic areas, wildlife habitat, and farmland for future generations. Executive Director Kevin Redding says their Land Jam program naturally gravitates toward bluegrass because there's such a rich history here in the Piedmont. He's joined by MIPSO guitarist, singer Joseph Terrell and fiddler Libby Rodenbaugh. Good old
days. Just recently, we closed on a 100-acre property in Alamance County, which in the future we're going to convey that to the county, and it will become a passive recreational park with trails and beautiful forests on it. We've got several activities going on along the Dan River in Stokes County mostly. We've acquired several hundred acres along the Dan this summer, and now we're trying to develop a plan for how to best use them. And we've also got a property that we're working on right now along the Blue Ridge Parkway, along the Surrey-Allegheny County line, that will protect some of the beautiful views from the parkway right along the North Carolina-Virginia boundary.
Without the sort of work that Piedmont Land Conservancy engages in on a day-to-day, those negotiations, those sometimes battles, we lose a whole lot in this region.
It is a rapidly developing area, and all the models show that in the next 20 to 50 years, that corridor between Atlanta to D.C. is just going to continue to grow. So we feel like our work is most important, because if we're going to protect the natural areas and the really special places of the Piedmont, we have to do it now. And eventually, in 50 to 100 years, whatever we're able to protect now is what's going to be protected.
Tell us about it, Kevin. What exactly is Land Jam?
Well, this year will be our 6th annual edition, and the last 5 years the show has morphed from our feeble attempt at educating people about what we do to our most successful outreach and education event to get people in and give them a wonderful night of music, but also to do some educational work on what is Piedmont Land Conservancy and why is our work important. And it's been very rewarding the last few years that people walk out of the show just thrilled to learn more about what we do, extremely grateful that now they understand a bit more about our region. And we've naturally gravitated towards bluegrass because so much wonderful music originates in our region and there's such a deep history here. And this year, both of the bands have connections to the Piedmont, which is even better.
So why is MIPSO a good fit for Land Jam?
Well, MIPSO is fabulous for us because three of the four members grew up in the Piedmont. And if you listen to the records or you go to their website, the songs have such a connection to the land and to North Carolina. You couldn't ask for a better relationship there. Must be Carolina calling me.
Must be Carolina in these things to follow me. MIPSO's Libby Rodenbaugh grew up studying classical violin, but she took time off in college to study folk music in Chicago and fiddle in Ireland.
I was familiar with the Piedmont Land Conservancy because my dad, who's an attorney here in Greensboro, has done work for them over the years. And actually, as a kid, I used to go to like stream cleanups and stuff with my dad for the Piedmont Land Conservancy. So I've known about them for most of my life, actually.
I love that aspect of what they do. Tell me about that experience early on and how it impacted you. Just getting your hands dirty and doing something for the environment.
Well, it was great. It was awesome. I mean, it turned me into a young naturalist, for sure. I already loved being outside, and it felt really cool that I could do something along with my dad and understand that his work as a lawyer was going to be benefiting people around the county in a really public way like that. It was a really cool thing for me.
Nice. I read through your bio that you were coming at your bluegrass music from a classical background. What were some of the biggest adjustments you picked up on during your year off studying folk music in Chicago and then later some fiddle in Ireland as well?
The biggest adjustment, which is pretty fundamental, is going from reading the music to just listening and making up the notes as you go along. So that was a pretty enormous adjustment. I mean, it really changed the way I thought about my instrument and just my relationship to music.
How so?
As a classical musician, I often felt that the only area I succeeded was the expressive element of playing, because I was not super technically gifted. And when you get to a point where you get to make up the notes yourself, that opens up a whole new expressive realm and, you know, creative area of playing music.
Does it go both ways? I mean, now that you've got improvisation as one of the tools in your toolkit, how does that enter in the world of, say, you're playing a Brahms concerto? Or how would it find its way there?
Well, I rarely play any concertos anymore. But when I get the chance to play classical, I think hopefully I have more of a, I don't know, a personal style. It was not something that I thought about as much as when I was playing classical. I sort of thought of myself like a drone or a robot or something. So now even when I play classical, I try to play as myself, as like a human being who has certain proclivities and feelings about the music, even if it's been written by somebody else.
How far along are you on this tour for Dark Collar Pop?
We've been touring that album for a good while now. And actually, as we're touring now, we're debuting a lot of new material, and we're already kind of thinking forward to the next album. The touring also now is an opportunity to try out new songs and be thinking about the future direction of our music.
What sorts of things coalesce or get better and better when you are on tour? What kind of comes together through that repetition that maybe the listener couldn't put a finger on but appreciates just because it sounds better?
Well, I mean, the word you hear all the time with bands is tighter. And there's only really one way to get tighter as a band, and that's just to play together really often and consistently. And so touring just sort of has that built in. You know, the more we play together, the more we're listening to each other, and the more we can, even aside from listening, the more we can anticipate how everybody's going to be playing on a certain song. And when you have that sort of structure built in, it gives you a lot of room to do more interesting things and to just have everything be especially crisp and fun to listen to. And it allows us to have a lot more fun on stage, too.
Mipso singer guitarist Joseph Terrell hails from High Point, where his grandma taught him his first song on guitar, Doc Watson's Tom Dooley.
We make music not in a vacuum, but around a lot of other people who are aware of the tradition and who make similar music alongside. And so we're always aware of other folks like the Steep Canyon Rangers who are making similar music in the bluegrass tradition. And so we always have folks to kind of look up to and learn from. And so it's never hard to remind ourselves that we have a long way to go. And we can still be proud of the music that we're making, and I'm definitely proud of our most recent album. But every step that we make getting better is also a reminder of what we have yet to learn. And so we try to remind ourselves that that journey is not over, and we're definitely getting better month to month.
Well, I want to thank you all for the great work on this album. Beginning with A Couple Acres Greener, this song to me, I mean, it has this feel of an old classic but with a very modern twist in it, and that combination of traits comes to a lot of your all's tune. Is that a conscious decision, or is it just happened? Well, you have that combination of textures or feel.
I think we certainly combine elements of the more traditional side of acoustic music and also new stuff. We're definitely conscious of it, though it's not something that we're stretching to do. I think it really comes naturally to us and to who we are. Part of that is, you know, we didn't grow up in the 1940s. We grew up in the 1990s, all of us, and so. Well, I started playing guitar with my grandmother, when I was about 10 years old, who started showing me some old bluegrass songs and old country songs. We also had the radio on, and I think the same could be said for the other members of the band. We didn't grow up in a cultural vacuum. We know what was going on, and part of what comes naturally to us is to pay homage to the traditions that we're aware of, while also tying in other things that just feel naturally and more relevant and new to us. This wicked winter just a couple acres greener.
I hear lines like Sunday morning never was as real as Friday night. I mean, I hear a line like that sung and the way you sing it. What's your process like in getting that together?
You know, I think of there's some sort of ratio, and I haven't nailed down exactly what the percentages are, but it's something like it's 10% listening for the right kind of inspiration and then 90% working really hard at it. And I think there's some sort of image of the songwriter, kind of like the poet, as someone who, you know, wanders off into the woods and gets inspiration from the leaves about what to write, and that's probably rarely true. It's a lot of sitting around and working really hard to write and edit and re-edit and then scrap it all and start over. But like I said, there's some sort of ratio where it's not all that, and you have to start out at some point with just listening. And whenever you turn onto a new CD, whenever you hear somebody say an interesting phrase, whenever one of your friends recommends to you a change in one of your songs, you know, it can be the spark for something new. The hard part, though, is once you get that spark, to work really hard to make it into something worth listening to.
Must be Carolina calling me. Must be Carolina in these things that follow me.
One of the things I love about your all's band is the three-part harmonies that you're able to generate, one of your trademarks. How hard is that? How hard do you got to work at them, just the harmonization that you all do?
You know, part of it is knowing music theory and knowing which notes fit together. And that's something that we've learned a lot about in the last few years, just getting better at the instruments that we play and the things that we sing. But the other part of it is understanding each other's voices. And to have a good harmony is a lot more than just singing the right notes in a certain chord. It's a lot about knowing how the timbres of the individual voices blend together. When you know each other's voices, there's something about knowing how to blend that really makes the harmony sound better. So I hope we're getting to where we're getting better at that.
I am a man, half a century from home. These kind of stands serve their master well.
Jacob Sharp sings the lead vocal on When I'm Gone. There's
That's
a
right.
really nice, delicate character to this song that I like. Beginning with the image of a little boy running into his grandma's arms and hiding in a blanket. So it really paints a picture. And I'm wondering if you could describe the way your all's mindset then changes up on stage from one tune to the next in performance. What do you got to go through to kind of get in that mindset?
That's true. We have some common themes that run through all of our songs, but sometimes there'll be some pretty wild juxtaposition between one and the next. And I think it's important to remember that we're telling stories, you know, we're storytellers. And when we go to a concert, we got about an hour and a half to tell an audience 20 stories. And if we're lucky, one or some of those will connect with them. So, like you said, when we're telling that story about a young boy running into his grandmother's arms, we got to think about the lyrics when we're singing them. And not recite them, but feel them as they come out of our mouth. So it's good to remember that. Sometimes it's funny because we'll have some songs that are, you know, expressing the angsty feeling of a, you know, a 17-year-old that feels like he needs to get out of the town that he grew up in. And then we have another kind of category of our music that's more about the feeling of being drawn to home. So sometimes these two songs with those polar opposite messages will be next to each other. But I don't think that's a contradiction in a bad way. I think life is full of contradictions, and to express them is just honest, and people identify with that.
Shallow, let me feel the tapping of the rain. We'll never know the place we all go from here. Be still my soul.
Piedmont Land Conservancy's Executive Director Kevin Redding, Mipso guitarist singer Joseph Terrell, and fiddler Libby Rodenbow. Piedmont Land Jam 2014, featuring Steep Canyon Rangers, Mipso, with special guest Laurelyn Dossett, is Friday night, October 17th at 8 o'clock in the historic Carolina Theater in Greensboro. Mipso's latest release is Dark Holler Pop. We've been sampling from that CD throughout the program, and you'll find links along with ticket information and more at WFDD.org, and click on Triad Arts Weekend.
And sing holy, holy, holy as I make my journey home.
I'm David Ford. Charlie Lovett's highly anticipated second novel is out on Viking Press. It's titled First Impressions, a novel of old books, unexpected love, and Jane Austen. We'll take a short break, and when we return, associate producer Bethany Chafin will share some of her first impressions. This is Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford. Associate producer Bethany Chafin explores Charlie Lovett's new book next.
Charlie Lovett's highly anticipated second novel is here. First Impressions, a novel of old books, unexpected love, and Jane Austen, is out now from Viking Press. In his new book, Lovett's protagonist, Sophie Collingwood, finds herself in the midst of a literary mystery. While working in an antiquarian bookstore, two customers request the second edition of an obscure 18th century book of allegories. The book calls into question the rightful authorship of Pride and Prejudice. Lovett masterfully moves between present-day England and the world of Jane Austen during the late 18th century. Charlie stopped by WFDD to tell me more.
As far as the idea for this book itself is concerned, it really came from one of the working titles of my previous book, The Bookman's Tale. And at one point, a working title for that book was The First Folio. And I thought, you know, well, if my first book is called The First Something, then maybe I could write a book called The Second Something. And being a book collector, I naturally thought about the second edition. And I came up with this idea of what if there was a book that was worthless in its first edition, but priceless in its second edition, which is kind of the opposite of what we usually think of as book collectors. What might that look like? And that was kind of the seed that grew into the main idea for First Impressions.
Well, you're describing first and second editions, and I wonder today, are there any books besides those used in, say, a school's curriculum that are released in editions that could have that kind of value, that perhaps the second edition is somewhat different or it holds a different meaning for the reader?
Well, certainly collectors today are still interested in owning first editions. If you collect modern literature, you're probably going to want to run out and buy a copy of the first printing of your favorite book or your favorite author when it first comes out. And that's going to be considered to be of greater value than a later printing. Ironically, in terms of the text, sometimes a later printing is actually better. I mean, even with my book, The Bookman's Tale, we found in the first hardcover printing, inevitably, you know, you find some mistakes or some tiny little things that you want to change. And those things got changed in the paperback printing, which came out a year later. So if you want higher quality text, you're going to maybe gravitate towards the paperback. But if you're a collector, you're going to want to have that first edition sitting on your shelf and see the text the way that the very first readers experienced it.
Well, you mentioned the point at which you started to appreciate Jane Austen. And I wonder if you could tell us what your first impression of Jane Austen was. And I understand that that occurred when you were about in seventh grade and you picked up Pride and Prejudice.
Yeah. You know, there's several reasons why my novel is called First Impressions. Most obviously, First Impressions was the working title that Jane Austen gave to the book that became Pride and Prejudice. But also, it is a novel about the misconceptions that we can have with our first impressions of things. And that's certainly the case with me and Jane Austen. I went through this period when I was in about seventh grade where I thought I should be reading more sophisticated books. I should be more grown up. I should look in the shelf where the ninth graders have their books and see what they have there. And so I first read Brave New World by Aldous Huxley, and I found that kind of slightly salacious and that thought, this is great. I love reading grown-up books. And the next thing I picked up was Pride and Prejudice because I'd heard my father talk about it. And at that age, I don't know what Jane Austen's intended audience for Pride and Prejudice was, but I'm pretty sure it wasn't 13-year-old American schoolboys of the 1970s. So I just sort of didn't get it. I thought it was kind of a very sappy soap opera, and it didn't strike me at all. And then when I came back to it in my 30s, picking books to read, I decided, let's give this another shot. And I just loved it. I thought it was so witty. I'd never gotten the humor of it when I was younger. And just witty and intelligent and so well crafted in terms of just the art of putting together a novel, which, you know, in a way you can almost see her inventing that art as you go from chapter to chapter.
Was it difficult to take a historical figure and place her into a work of fiction? What was that process like?
Well, it's an interesting process. I had a discussion about this with another historical novelist right before I started working on First Impressions, and we agreed that you don't want to know too much about the person that you're writing a fictional version of, because you are writing a novel, and ultimately I'm writing Jane Austen as a character in a novel, not as a real person in a biography. And so she needs to act and react as the character in the fictional world that I'm creating. Having said that, I'm creating a fictional world that overlaps largely with the real world that the real Jane Austen lived in. So I do need to know certain things. So to get the basic facts of her life right, I actually went to the first biography, which was written by a couple of her descendants. And I just wanted to make sure that I had her living in the right places in the right times, that I had the family members' ages and relative ages and names correct, that I had her writing her books at the correct time, those sort of basic facts of her life. But as far as crafting her personality, I really didn't want that to come from the biography. I wanted it to come from the novels. So I went back and reread the novels and especially paid attention to the three novels that are featured in my novel, in First Impressions, which are Pride and Prejudice, Sense and Sensibility, and Northanger Abbey. And I wanted to create a character that seemed to me to be the sort of person who would write those sorts of novels. So to me, Jane was, as I said, very witty, very intelligent, sort of bold, independent, almost quietly revolutionary in terms of sort of breaking out of the mold of a traditional woman's role.
Tell me about her friend, Richard Mansfield.
Well, Richard Mansfield is a fictional character in my novel, First Impressions. I was playing around in this novel with some ideas about love. And in a lot of novels, love is very much about two young people having a romance and getting together and living happily ever after, or failing to get together and not living happily ever after. But I felt like there's a lot more manifestations of love in the world than just two young people in a romantic relationship. And so I wanted to explore some of those. And I ended up exploring these two relationships, one in the modern day with Sophie Collingwood, the hero of the novel, and her uncle, who sort of introduces her to this world of rare books and book collecting and English literature. And the other one between Jane Austen and this fictional retired clergyman, Richard Mansfield, who has sort of dabbled a little bit in being a writer himself, and in my novel ends up being somewhat of a mentor to Jane in her early writing years, helping her and encouraging her and making suggestions about how to improve her writing and just being a person that she can read to and talk to.
Writer, teacher, and playwright Charlie Lovett. Lovett's second novel, First Impressions, is now out from Viking Press. You can hear Charlie on Monday, November 3rd at Barnes & Noble in Winston-Salem for a talk, question and answer session, and a book signing at 7 p.m. For more information, visit our website at wfdd.org and click on Triad Arts Weekend.
Associate producer Bethany Chafin. This is Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford. Once again, associate producer Bethany Chafin is back, this time with a new book that's literally hot off the press.
Denver-based writer Wendy J. Fox and her collection The Seven Stages of Anger and Other Stories won the inaugural Press 53 Award for Short Fiction. The author's debut collection will be published on October 17th. Press 53's Kevin Morgan Watson notes, "What impressed me most about Wendy's collection was her attention to detail, not just with everyday items, but with emotions, word choices, actions." Wendy's stories have appeared in literary journals and magazines such as Washington Square Review, The Pinch, Madison Review, and more. She holds an MFA from the Inland Northwest Center for Writers. I spoke with Wendy from her home in Denver about her journey as a writer.
The MFA program that I went to, I think, is structured pretty typically for an MFA in that you have a combination of workshop classes, and in what they call a studio program, there is an emphasis on that workshop component of it. But you also have other classes that might be related to the industry. So, for example, if the university has a university press, you might be able to intern there. MFA students also have teaching assistantships. When I was in the MFA program, I directed a program called Writers in the Community, where we matched up MFA students to places of community need. So, for example, I taught in a prison for 2 years, helping people with the writing portion of the GED. We also had students who taught in nursing homes and elementary schools. So there was that part, which I think was really important for helping people understand how writing can be meaningful to the larger world.
What did your career trajectory and what did your writing life look like after you finished your MFA?
I did what a lot of people do, and I started teaching. And at that time, I had this idea that I would give myself 3 years. And if 3 years passed and I didn't have a book out, then I would go back for a PhD. And then the 3 years passed and there wasn't a book. And then I went abroad for a while, and then I came back, and I really kind of floated, and it took me a while to get my writing life dialed in, because I think it was difficult, and I think this is difficult for a lot of people, making that transition out of an academic setting to figuring out how you can work on your writing life in an everyday capacity. I suddenly had this way in which I found kind of a space to carve out time for writing. Block it off on the calendar and make yourself sit down and do it, which is hard and is not romantic in terms of creative process, but that's something that's worked really well for me.
If you've submitted a story and say a rejection letter comes back, do you revisit that story? Do you edit it again? Or do you remain confident in the fact that, you know, this is how the story needs to be and it wasn't the right fit right now?
If a story is rejected, sometimes it's because the writer is looking in the wrong place for a home for it. So you haven't sent it to the right magazine. Or maybe you've sent it to the right magazine, but you didn't get a reader who related to the story, and that's fine too. if I get many, many rejections on a story, I do revisit it. And a lot of stories I'll go back and revisit anyway, just because the way that you can approach them changes once you have some space away from it. Sometimes magazine editors are nice enough to send a note. For example, this sounds like it's part of something larger, or the ending didn't speak to us, or we got lost in the middle. And that can be really helpful because you know that the story was good enough that someone cared enough to write you back with a comment.
Well, obviously, Kevin and Christine at Press 53 related to your work, loved it. And what is the relationship of working with a small press like through the editing process and now the actual publication date? What's that been like?
Working with a small press has been really wonderful. Kevin and Christine at Press 53 have been absolutely phenomenal to work with in terms of being really transparent about the process, sharing early cover ideas, sharing early typesetting, and obviously they are the experts in book production, but there were several times that I had some comments and some feedback, and I felt like they always really listened. I haven't had the experience of working with a massive New York publishing house, but my sense is that it's a different experience to really feel like you have your voice heard in terms of the production of the book.
I understand that you've moved around quite a bit, and it's interesting knowing that when I look at some of your characters and how much they are perhaps tied to where they came from. That might be their family, that might be an actual physical structure of a home, or it might be like a landscape, like a, you know, Washington or Colorado. Tell me about, you know, the meaning of home.
For me, place is totally inextricable from the characters that I am interested in, because I feel like place, landscapes, and, you know, even structures that you live in, work in, see every day, that this stuff is just part of your everyday perception of the world that you're in, and there's no way that you can not experience it. So I think that stuff is really, really interesting, and I think it's also really interesting in the U.S. because we're such a diverse nation in terms of all kinds of things, but even place. I mean, this is a country that Honolulu and Bismarck are in the same nation. It's incredible to me.
In addition to her vivid descriptions of place, Wendy Fox writes characters that are distinct and nuanced, yet in many ways also linked together.
I think that in all of the stories, the camera is pretty close, like the perspective is pretty close to that character. And what I have been interested in as a writer is the very small things that happen to us. So these stories are not particularly plot-driven. They do have plots, but they are not plot-driven. They're driven by the characters, and that's what gives the stories momentum. I hope that readers have the experience of feeling very close to the individual characters, even if on the surface that character isn't someone who they don't actually really resemble. But I hope that the effect of being very close and close to their thoughts gives them the experience that these folks are having.
Writer Wendy J. Fox will be in Winston-Salem at the launch party for The Seven Stages of Anger and Other Stories on Friday, October 17th at the Artworks Gallery. The event begins at 7 p.m. Wendy will also be participating in Press 53 and Prime Number Magazine's Gathering of Writers on Saturday, October 18th. The event will be a day-long series of workshops for writers of all levels. Wendy's workshop specifically will focus on using description to help make characters and scenes feel real. Other faculty members include David Jouse, Kim Church, David James Poissant, and Lee Zacharias. For more information, visit our website at wfdd.org and click on Triad Arts Weekend.
Associate producer Bethany Chafin. This is Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford. After a little intermission, we'll set down our books and enter the fascinating world of acclaimed artist Spencer Finch. His work is on display for another week and a half at Haynes Gallery on the Wake Forest University campus. And after you hear about him, you may find yourself inclined to go check it out next when Triad Arts Weekend continues. This is Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford. On the campus of Wake Forest University, the Haynes Gallery there, you'll find a most unusual art exhibition. A special ice machine cycles color-calibrated water to replicate the specific color of the sky directly above New Zealand's Franz Josef Glacier at a precise date and time. A programmable fan replicates the breeze as it flowed through Emily Dickinson's window on August 14, 2012. And much more. Haynes Gallery director Paul Bright says that after viewing Spencer Finch's work, a sculpture in neon tubes, a watercolor, you quickly understand that he's playing with light and how we experience things. But Paul's interest in Spencer's work lies in that which ties it all together. He refers to Spencer as a phenomenologist, interested in not only how we perceive the world, but how we process those perceptions to make sense of the world around us. On Tuesday night, October 21st, from 5:30 to 7, the Spencer Finch Lecture comes to the Porter Byram Welcome Center, Kulinich Auditorium, 1834 Wake Forest Road in Winston-Salem. Spencer was in the 2004 Whitney Biennial, and the first retrospective of his work in 2007-8 took place at Mass MoCA. Finch was the only artist commissioned to create work for the just-opened 9/11 Memorial Museum, and he recently completed an installation at the Morgan Library in New York. You can see his work, for free, on display at Haynes Gallery through October 27th. Director Paul Bright shared some of the things that interest him most about Spencer Finch's remarkable art.
So I saw Fathom at the James Cohen Gallery about a year ago, May, and it's a length of rope coiled on the gallery floor, and the gallery is a pretty good size space. And at first, you're not quite sure what you're looking at. And the rope is marked at intervals with these little tags, and they have little swatches of color on them and maybe some written indication. And it turns out that the tags record the perceived color of the water at any of the given depth readings that he took and marked on the rope.
And water from Walden Pond.
Walden Pond, yes. And, you know, he keeps coming back to these New England writers, Emily Dickinson and Thoreau and those guys. That seems to be a touchstone for him.
I love the image of that. First off, I mean, there were like 266 tags. I mean, he's really obsessive in his chronicling of the variance in light. It points to, and I want to get to the Dickinson piece too with Wynn, because that's coming to Haynes Gallery.
It's the one we have here. Yeah.
But first, this notion that you can somehow capture something as complex as the variance of color within a lake. So he goes about it very empirically, and yet he's aware of the ephemeral nature of these things that we see, and that they come and go.
Yeah, he's aware that the enterprise on some level always fails. And the failure points to the humanness in the perception and how we actually make sense of the visible world or the sensory world.
Yeah.
And process it and make a new meaning out of it.
I just admire that. There's something really exciting about that, because I'll never do that.
Well, it's funny. With a lot of artists, I think obsession binds them. They often share that. What that obsession is what makes their art different.
Yeah. Well, speaking of obsession, I mean, Emily Dickinson could be a classic example of obsession in so many levels, but the great poet, and I can't remember the poem where she describes the blue buzz of a fly just outside her window, but windows and wind coming in plays a role, and he takes us to the nth degree. Finch really studies that wind in a piece of art.
I think it's really important to realize the role of the window metaphorically for her poetry, for Emily Dickinson's poetry, in that she was very hermetic, and this was a portal onto the world for her, and so for her, the window probably had a greater importance than it would for most people. And maybe Spencer felt that too and locked into that and spent this period of time in her room one day and brought his instruments and recorded the velocity of the breeze coming in as well as the frequency. So he made measurements and went back and I think probably thought about how he might translate this into a piece of sculpture or an artwork of some kind. And the result is this fan, typical box fan, that has a little computer brain that then replicates the intervals and the velocities of the wind that he experienced.
Wow. Have you sat in front of the wind and felt it? What's that experience like?
It's very interesting because you're looking at this thing that's obviously just a common object. And at the same time, you're transported a little bit into a different mindset. It's like this very banal object is also a very poetic vehicle for thought or sensation.
Haynes Gallery director Paul Bright. Spencer Finch, Color, Temperature will remain on display at Haynes Gallery with dozens of Finch's works through October 27th. On Tuesday, October 21st, Spencer Finch will speak at 5:30 in the Byram Welcome Center on the Wake Forest University campus. You'll find links to more information at WFDD.org and click on Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford. The Healing Blues Project invites folks experiencing things such as homelessness, post-traumatic stress disorder, or abuse to share a story about the challenges they face with a participating songwriter. The songwriter collaborates with the storyteller in writing and performing their song for a fascinating new recording. The Healing Blues CD memorializes the personal struggles of nearly a dozen participants in living music. The Healing Blues Project is an interdisciplinary collaboration between Greensboro College faculty cross-disciplinary artist Ted Elframoff, composer-pianist Dave Fox, and art students Julia Fergus and Gabrielle Harvin. Also involved are the Interactive Resource Center, a day resource center for people experiencing homelessness, Greensboro area songwriters, and storytellers from the Greensboro community. Ted and Dave spoke with me over the summer while the Healing Blues Project was still in production. Talk about your personal interest in social justice. Where does it come from?
Well, I grew up in the Soviet Union. I was born in 1964. And as a kid growing up in Russia, I already kind of saw that, especially coming from my family's sort of disengagement from the government, let's say, from the Soviet powers that be, I saw that things weren't right. You know, and I thought that, you know, why can't we travel outside of Russia, for instance? You know, it's closed society. And in 1990, I went back to Russia, and I witnessed a huge change. I came from the Soviet Union in 1980. And when I came back in 1990, I saw homelessness, for instance, which you never saw in the Soviet Union. I saw a lot of change that was disheartening in a way. And that kind of led me to a path of creating art based on my sort of political or emotional feelings and beliefs. Open Art Society sent out a call to artists for installations done in downtown Greensboro in either abandoned storefronts or empty storefronts. She was working with the Piedmont Blues Preservation Society, and I think it was kind of a workup to the Blues Festival that's in May. And so she asked artists to create installations in these empty storefronts that would be dealing with the blues. My idea was to create not a static installation, but a kind of a blues cafe where musicians would get together with storytellers and create blues songs. And then thinking about the nature of the blues, it's sort of about memorializing your own suffering. I thought, well, who are the people suffering in this city right now? And I automatically thought about homeless folks and people at IRC or people like veterans with PTSD. So I thought, well, why don't we get these people together and hook them up with blues musicians and then have them create these songs. So that's when I kind of wrote a little proposal for the project, and then I got in touch with Dave Fox, and Dave said, I love the idea, and I just happen to know pretty much every blues musician in the area. And he jumped right on it, so we've forged this collaboration.
And Dave, you have one of the most varied sets of musical influences of anyone I know. Could you give listeners a sample of some of the biggies in your life?
People like Mozart and Beethoven and Schumann and Brahms, Bill Evans, Miles Davis, and even some of the real crazy out there people like Cecil Taylor and Butch Morris, who's the guy who came up with conduction, where you get a bunch of people together who've never played together before, and just by hand signals you create a piece on the spot. And then, of course, the Beatles. I mean, it's like, I guess it's, I don't remember who said it, but anything that's good, I like it. And I guess I kind of don't feel bound by barriers. People say this has to be this genre, it has to be that genre. I kind of just, if it's good, I like it, and I like to explore how sounds are put together.
The late, great Duke Ellington said there are two types of music. You know,
good and bad.
Good music and the other kind, you know, whatever it is. So what's the draw for you in this kind of social justice aspect of this particular project?
Well, because I haven't really done too much of that before. I guess, like a lot of artists, not that there's anything wrong with this, to be an artist, whether it's music or visual artist, filmmaker, whatever, you have to spend a lot of time with yourself, honing your discipline, getting better at what you do. A lot of alone time, a lot of me time, a lot of kind of ego time, you know. And Ted brought this idea up, and I'd read of other people doing things similar to this. I thought, man, this is a way I can kind of do something unselfish to kind of maybe give back to the community. And that's kind of what I saw my role as, to get all these other great blues musicians that I'd gotten to know over the past few years in Greensboro and Winston-Salem, give them the same opportunity. So I'd call people up and they would say, yeah, I'd love to do that. And then they'd come out for the first session, they'd meet a storyteller, and they were just having a blast doing it. And everyone who I've called and everyone who's done it has just had the best things to say about it. Like, they're really, I don't want to say it's a life-changing experience, but it's close to that. Like, people are really getting into this. They love the idea of using their art to help someone else out.
Tell me about the IRC, the Interactive Resource Center. What is it, and what do they do?
So the IRC is a sort of a day center for homeless folks who can come in and take a shower or get some job training or participate in an arts activity. And one thing I saw that really made the place stand apart was that there was a kind of an agency for homeless folks to have at the IRC. For instance, they have a artist collaborative. So homeless folks who are artists create art and run a collaborative. So any money they make, some of it goes back into the collaborative. And I think what Liz Seymour's vision is to give folks that are kind of down an agency to support themselves and to support themselves in community. And I think that's what's happening at IRC, and it's very exciting to watch.
How is Greensboro College supporting IRC and this project?
Greensboro College is the entity through which we are participating in this project, as we're both professors at Greensboro College, and we're engaging our students. So I have a couple of art students involved in the project. Dave is going to have a couple of music students involved in the project. We're going to be involving some history students. So, you know, I think it's we're getting marketing support and we're getting institutional support from the college to kind of put together a body of work, let's say, in relationship to this project.
Houses pass by me, all shapes and colors, apartments, trailers, belonging to others. Was there a time way back when? Tell me I had a chance then. Riding the bus, I frame my window. Buildings abandoned, ain't it so? One day after another, me and him, thinking about a life that might have been. Just wishes in the rain. I did all the wrong things, don't you know? All this pain inside has nowhere to go. Today, tomorrow, yesterday ain't right. Close my eyes, I die a little every
night. Now, have both of you all been involved in, either as a fly on the wall or participant in the collaborative process between storyteller and musician? Have you been just facilitating that, Dave, or have you actually sat in on one of those sessions?
I've sat in on a couple of them, and then I decided that the first day, as I saw how the project was going to grow, to not actually write a song myself, just act as the overall producer for the whole thing.
Tell me about that back and forth.
So we're teaming up blues songwriters with either a homeless person or someone who has trauma in their life. We call them the storyteller. So the storyteller tells a story to the blues songwriter, and the two of them together are getting credit for the song that's coming out. One of the blues musicians just brought a list of questions with them and just asked them what happened in your early life and stuff like that. I can't remember what all the questions were. But they told me later that once they asked the first question, they never asked any other question because the person kept talking, and they found out later they had answered all the questions they had had anyway. Others have been poems written by a storyteller already. They would bring them with them and say, well, here's a poem I wrote, and they would stand up and read it. And one of them was just so moving and so powerful that one of the songwriters right there said, well I'm going to take that. And there's been two or three instances like that.
We talked a little bit early on about the reaction you've got, at least signing up and jumping on board with the project, from the blues musicians themselves. But what sorts of feedback have you gotten from the storytellers, these people that are going through so much stress in their life about this project?
One reaction in particular that's been documented and was in a Greensboro News article, where Greensboro News and Record brought a photographer down to the IRC, and the songwriter came down there with his guitar, and a friend of his was singing it, and the storyteller heard the song for the very first time, based on his story. And it was a very moving kind of story, because he talks about a picture of his dad that he carries with him, and a cross that he carries with him that his mom gave with him, I think, something like that. And they were able to put the lines of those two things in the song. We heard those, his face just lit up, and he was dancing, and he was moving around. So far, it's based on that, the reactions have been very overwhelmingly positive.
That storyteller's name is Shannon Stewart, and the songwriters are Terry and Janice Von Cannon. And we have set up some what we call Healing Blues Cafes at Elsewhere Museum, where the songwriters and storytellers come together, and the songwriters perform the songs for the first time. And when Terry performed the song, Shannon was not there. So then Terry decided to come down to the IRC the next day and perform for Shannon. So it was quite a moving experience.
Greensboro College faculty cross-disciplinary artist Ted Elframoff and composer-pianist Dave Fox. We've been sampling from the Healing Blues CD. It's just been released, and you'll find links to where you might find yourself a copy at WFDD.org and click on Triad Arts Weekend.
Headed south from the city, looking to leave my troubles behind. Went to Virginia, crossing state lines. I can run, I can hide, but I can't get away from what's inside. Pushed on to Carolina,
oh, Carolina,
hoping to ease my pain.
Ease my pain.
But at every crossroad,
I'm at the crossroad,
I traded hope for shame. I can run, I can hide, but I can't get away from what's inside. Thought I'd take my chances, shift my circumstances, but there's only so far south I can go. Change what's inside.
take my chances, shift my circumstances, but there's only so far south. I can take my chances, shift my circumstances, but there's only so far south I can go.
Well, that's all for today's program. Our technical producer is Eddie Garcia, our associate producer is Bethany Chafin, and our intern is Jorge Clifton. You'll find podcasts and archived episodes of Triad Arts Weekend, along with photos, links to ticket information, and more at WFDD.org, and click on Triad Arts Weekend. And as always, we'd love to hear from you. Please send your questions, comments, and suggestions to triadarts@wfu.edu. I'm David Ford. Thanks for listening to Triad Arts Weekend.